This tape is a production of All Roads Ministries. This tape is a live recording of a talk given by Vincent Lewis, the head and founder of All Roads Ministry, at the Catholic Rendezvous, which took place in November of 1990 in Connecticut. As with all live recordings, it has the spontaneity and the difficulties of live recording. And as with such things, we ask you to understand that occasionally, because of that, there may be certain parts that are slightly inaudible or which are masked by the sounds of the response of the audience. The tape begins with the introduction by William Knisney, who is the founder and head of the organization known as the Catholic Rendezvous. And at the end of the live speech, there is a postscript given by Vincent Lewis. This tape is a production of All Roads Ministries. And additional copies may be obtained by contacting us. The address is given at the end of the recording. Thank you.
Physically, mentally, and psychologically, and this talk that they're going to give, I have no idea what it'll be, but we know it's going to be interesting, to say the least. Do we invite him? Did you hear Benny's little remark over there that I think is worth repeating? Someone carrying a sign with a fetus on his frock, and one of the anti-nukes said, "That looks like a monkey up there."
Yeah.
And he says, "That was a monkey you'd be down with us this afternoon." They don't like to go lucky. Margaret Church is looking for her soul. What is it, Margaret? You lost your soul? A little book someone stole from Margaret. Take it out of her pocket.
Somebody just got
out of her house.
That was a preacher. Look at it. He
doesn't have to do the budget.
Well, I would like to say that so far the other talks have been so good that I have no disagreements and I have nothing to add, and I'm therefore forfeiting my time to speak. Cindy thought it was funny, so I'd give it a shot. Okay. I have an administrative announcement. Carl Keating has graciously accepted an offer of mine. And this is a serious thing. We will run some kind of discussion on our disagreements of the nature of Protestantism versus the Catholicism versus salvation tomorrow, sometime probably between Mass and lunch. It'll be sort of informal. We'll probably not be in this room. Obviously, you're all invited. And the only thing that's serious about it is that the loser of that debate will go to hell. So you might want to attend it. Okay, now, as I understood the nature of this talk, what we were trying to deal with is this concept of Christendom, the church, society, and culture, and I think I'm somewhat related to Gary before me. As a matter of fact, I wrote a few notes, and I hope I remember to include them. Primarily, this concept of Christendom seems to me the basic that we're dealing with, and I want to first say that historians always have a problem. They have to write the past in terms of the present. And of course, the people at the time were in the terms of the present, and they don't always arrange to have their popes and their presidents die at exactly certain times. So therefore, historians have to, in order to classify things, use terms which don't necessarily reflect reality. So we have concepts of the age of reason, the age of faith, the so-called dark ages, the ancient times. Well, those people didn't know they were in the ancient times. They were in the modern times. So sometimes a term such as Christendom can be meaningful simply as an historical convenience or an historical conceit, even though it does not have a sense of reality. The people in the Age of Reason were not necessarily any more reasonable than we are. The people in the ancient time thought they were, as I say, in modern time. Understanding this, my basic premise is that the Church, and of course I mean the Catholic Church, does not and should not have any relationship whatsoever with that which we call society. And by society, I mean, this is the word which we use to describe that man-made creation, which is the situation that occurs when relationships between people become complex or inconvenient. And I define inconvenient as usually meaning requiring an act of virtue. And what I'm saying is, in my brief remarks here, what I will essentially advocate
is that, number one, there is no relationship, because essentially there is really not society from any Christian point of view. And secondly, there should not be, even though we might in some circumstances use that word to describe these things. My first thing is scriptural. Jesus and St. Paul talk about these things. The first thing that St. Paul says clearly is, be of the world, not in it. Society is a human, earthly creation. If we are to be of society, then we are of the world. But we have to be only in it physically, because we're here now. We must not be of it. We must not be associated any more than we can. Number two, St. Paul says there's three sources of evil: the world, the flesh, and the devil. I think clearly by this he means the world being those complex relationships where they're then now come under that rubric of sociology. We are to avoid this. Third, Jesus says frequently that the reign of God is at hand and within you. Now, Jesus certainly is a king. He's certainly establishing a kingdom. He certainly established an institution of a church. But his political statements seem to be filled with indifference and ambiguity. The concept of rendering to Caesar unto Caesar and that unto God which is God can come to almost any definition. It can be applied almost anywhere. An Austrian economist, Ludwig von Mises, once said that the advantage of Christianity was that the basic tenets of Christianity as expressed in Scripture are so sketchy they can be applied anywhere. And that's why Christianity will always be a living religion, while Judaism and Islam are dead. Because their precepts are so overwhelming, so precise, so pervasive, they force a culture into a religious straitjacket and then kill it. While Christianity can survive, prosper, and or wither in any culture, any government, any nation whatsoever. Now also, again, scripturally, in the epistles of St. Peter and St. Paul, we have this statement that we ought to pray for all men, especially leaders. And we have this statement, in essence, which says that even the man who slays you, if he is a government official, is God's anointed. Obey him. Now, that's a rather interesting thing to say when Nero was burning people because they were Christians, and that's when these letters were written, so it is believed. The point there, I believe, the conclusion we have to come to here, is to become indifferent to governments, become indifferent to culture, society, and instead stay with yourself. Okay? Now, again, the basic premise which I'm working on is that God deals with man individually, man deals with God directly, through the church, through the sacraments, and you deal with your fellow man for the sake of God individually. Now, one of the other problems with this, why we should not have a relationship with society, is that society frequently allows us to see as good what is in fact evil. And I thought of two analogies or two examples of this. The first is unions. I'm not saying all unions are bad. But right now, there's a strike going on in New York City in the Daily News. And I happen to have a relative who works for the Daily News. In essence, what these guys are striking for, and if you listen for their rhetoric, they sound like pro-lifers willing to go to jail forever. We are going to stay out forever. We are going to stay here. This is a principle. They're not going to break the union. What are the principles they're fighting for? The principles they are fighting for is that a man may come to work, sleep for 12 hours, and be paid overtime. What else are they fighting for? That he may damage the machines rather than allowing the employer to renovate the machines. What else are they fighting for? That he may steal. What else are they fighting for? That they may burn the trucks of the employer. That they may attack the drivers of the trucks and throw the papers into the East River so that nobody can read them. Then, what does the strike lead to, as it did in almost all the other newspaper strikes, is the destruction of jobs. You put an unvirtuous suffering on the family of the men who brought about this first. Again, suffering can certainly be virtuous. But if it is not done for the right reason, it is quite literally just a pain in the neck. Now, what you have then, therefore, is poverty being spread among families who don't have any conception on why their husband or their brother or their father went out on strike. Why did they go out on strike? So that the employer is deprived of the God-given right to maintain an open and free contract with his employees. Now, but the rhetoric is presented in such a fashion to make us believe that this is a high and noble cause. Again, if you listen to the words, it's absurd. And almost every strike is this way. So the strikers who overturn the milk trucks so they can't get to the hospitals, and the hospital workers who prevent the ambulances from getting in so that people die or suffer unnecessarily, present themselves in some noble cause. It is good to do good things. It is bad to do evil things. But when the two get confused, and when evil masquerades as good, that is far worse. The second concept is taxes.
None of us like taxes. Some of us will argue that they are justified or so they are not. But the point is this. If I take from this person $2,000 of their $10,000 of income and give that to some social program, number one, I have reduced the amount of money that she can give, as St. Paul says, that balance, no amount of charity should impoverish you, to give in her own personal ways to charity. Also, by the same token, if she wants to use it as an excuse, and Lord knows we're all looking for excuses for our evil, we can say, my $2,000 has gone through a federal program to feed someone in Appalachia. Therefore, I have done good. Therefore, my virtue has been met. My obligation has been met. Therefore, I do not have to confront my fellow man. I do not have to listen to the cries of the hungry. I do not have to find out about my friend. My government takes care of it. Now, the really terrifying thing about this is, who gets the virtue? Who gets the grace? Is it the bureaucrat who stamps something? Is it the guy who actually makes the truck delivery? Well, what we've done is taking what could have been a good act and deprived someone from getting grace from it. And that's a terrifying thought to me. The third reason on why the church should not be in society is we have found that you can be a saint in every culture. One of the great advantages of Catholicism is the constant process of canonization, and of course those who keep up with us or even just read every now and then find that there were saints who were kings, and there were saints who were beggars, and saints who were teachers, and saints in Korea, and saints in Japan, and saints in South America, and I assume eventually Australia. The point is, every culture, every time, every place, there's been saints. Now, by definition, a saint means a guy who, through special heroic virtue, is not only guaranteed in heaven, but is held up to us as an example of how we should behave, someone we should imitate. If that can be done in every culture, in every government, in every situation, including some situations in which the, again, quote, society was extremely anti-Catholic, then what we come up with is the necessary relationship between these two, if it's very, very good, or if it's very, very bad, doesn't seem to make a difference on what the individual can achieve. If you can achieve sanctity, if you can achieve heroic virtue, if you can achieve salvation no matter what the society is, then there is no necessary relationship between the two. And as I was saying before, there is the possibility of it being dangerous. And that brings me to my next point. Sin and virtue are internal. That does not mean to say they should not be expressed externally. But as I pointed out before in a discussion with someone, the sin of abortion, not the act of abortion, occurs when the mother decides to kill her child. Whether she carries it out or not, the sin has been committed. And I'm not judging whether it's a mortal sin or a venial sin. The point is, by the same sense, if you decide that your neighbor next door needs help, let's say his walk needs to be shoveled or he needs a bag of potatoes, you take the bag of potatoes, you put them over your shoulder, you start to walk over there, and you die. Well, you've already got the credit, because it was when you intended to do the good, the same as when you intended to do the evil, that these things are done. Now, the problem with this in our culture is, what it does is it seems to give this mistake, and this is echoed an excellent point that Gary Potter made, it's quoting the Pope, talking about this concept of the supernatural versus the natural virtues, okay, that somehow the outward activity is enough. That the feeding of the hungry and the clothing of the naked, outside of the context of Catholicism, is enough. Well, it's not enough. If you don't do it, we, who have been enlightened, who have been given the grace of baptism, who have been given the truth of Catholicism, if we do not do it because we say, follow God's command, okay, simply that way, or somehow see Jesus in all of them, I don't care, it's sort of the same thing. But if we don't do it for supernatural virtue, then what difference are we than the communist official who simply distributes food to the people under his control? What difference are we then than the guy who holds the pro-life activist in jail but gives them food when he should be releasing them? There's no difference. They're also feeding the hungry. They're also visiting the imprisoned. They're also clothing the naked. But they're doing it for the wrong reason. And if we want to get to that naturalism that somehow it is only the activity that matters, then we've lost the essence of Christianity. We've lost the essence of Catholicism, which is the internal act of will, the conformity of one's mind, one's heart, one's will, and then ultimately one's body with the will of God. The body follows last. All those other things have to be in accord. If the body goes first, what you're dealing with naturalism. And I don't see any way that one can say that that will save you in and of itself, because after all, we are truly saved by faith. Now, those are the reasons I believe that, the last one on why I believe we should not is the concept of natural work versus supernatural grace. I've alluded to it briefly before. The concept is that Jesus and God deals with us individually, each individual man. Each individual man is given a conscience, he's given natural law, he's given actual grace, if not sanctifying grace, to work out his own salvation in fear and trembling. That is the way we do it. Yes, to quote my Protestant brothers, we must have a personal relationship with Jesus to be saved. Absolutely. We don't go to heaven in groups and we don't go to hell in groups. We go both places individually. We don't arrive at the judgment gate and say, I'm sorry, I was on the Titanic. Where do we go? No way. We get the individual judgment, okay? And the individual judgment depends on how we related individually to God and how we related individually to our fellow man. Now, again, if we feeding the hungry and clothing the naked and somehow ignoring the guy next door to us, then we're not really being fully Christian. I remember someone told me not so long ago, if you're as old as I am, I think you've probably heard this quote many times, you have to love your neighbor, but you don't have to like him. Well, someone told me the opposite, you really do have to like him. And I thought it was an interesting point. If you're really thinking of him as Jesus, you do have to like him. And when I get angry on the guy on the road and I'm trying to say, well, Jesus, I say, well, Jesus wouldn't run the stop sign on me. Okay, well, it's an act of will. Maybe Jesus would to test me. I have to really try to like the guy. And I have to develop a personal relationship. And to use the classic example, which I think is perfect for this, is the Good Samaritan. When the Good Samaritan walked by the guy who had fallen among the robbers, he did not write a letter to the New York Times about law enforcement. He did not form a vigilante committee. He did not sign a disposition. He dealt with the problem, which was right there on a one-on-one basis. And there was no comment whatsoever that he even put a sign up saying, warning, neighborhood watch, robbers in the area. He didn't care about his culture. He didn't care about his society. He didn't care about anybody else. He saw a man suffering, and he did something about it. Just as Jesus did. The interesting point I think sometimes that we miss about Jesus is that after Jesus rose from the dead, after the church was established, after St. Peter and St. John are walking around in a temple, they come across a guy who begged every day at the temple who was crippled. Begged every day at the temple who was crippled. How come he missed Jesus? Well, Jesus didn't cure everybody. Jesus cured individuals. He didn't cure in mass. Every healing was individual. They fed them in a certain sense, and of course it was an actual miracle, but it was also through the apostles, and there's of course a lot of symbolism here, representation of the Eucharist. Sure, we all understand that. But his miracles of healing were individuals, not collective. And he left people to be healed for his apostles. And we must assume that some of them never got healed at all. There wasn't a social consciousness here. There was an individual relationship being established. That was it. Now, one of the reasons I'm arguing that the church should not have this is because I'm also arguing that the church never did. So therefore, what I want to do is make a couple of historical comments. One is, there seems to be an assumption, which I don't believe is correct at all, is that, quote, we, that is our spiritual ancestors, were more Christian in the old days. And therefore, it was better then. That's when the church really influenced things. I mean, after all, look at the law codes in France in the Middle Ages. Look at England. Look at the time when everybody built the great cathedrals and stuff like this. Right. And that's frequently used about how influential they are. But one of the points is that, yes, the great cathedral was built. It was built once, usually by the act of one or two men. And perhaps they literally enforced their will on others. And I'm not denying these things are marvelous, but are they really reflections of faith, or are they lucky accidents? And the reason they're still there and nothing else has survived is because they were built better. How many houses of prostitution were built around the Cathedral of Chartres? We don't know, because they weren't built as well. How many other places which were dens of iniquity, which were places where drunks got rolled, which were inns where the innkeeper cheated the people who came? We don't know. They didn't survive. So we have a situation where, sort of like in the island, we're only seeing we're only seeing the tops of the island where the continents once existed. Who knows? I don't know. How many of the people actually lived their faith in those days? We don't know. But I know this, that my reading of the history of the ages of faith is filled with heresies, with violence, with injustice, with rejection of Catholicism, and with bloodshed of the simple folk, of the ordinary people. I see that in those days, it seems to me the common life, again, of the common literature I'm able to believe, was pretty much as now. You had to keep your hand on your wallet or it would be stolen. We again, Hildebrand, Gregory the Seventh, one of the greatest popes who ever lived, died in exile. He died in exile because the majority of the Catholic Church at least was shutting up enough when the Holy Roman Emperor was chasing him out of Rome and putting an anti-pope in the chair of St. Peter. This happened frequently. Innocent III, who the historians call the greatest, most powerful pope of the Middle Ages, the one who gave approval to St. Francis of Assisi, which is an interesting point. I'll digress slightly. St. Francis of Assisi got the entry to Innocent III because of a dream Innocent III had, which was what? A man's going to come here, the church is falling down, push it up. And Innocent III said, so pray to God, the church is falling down. Wait a minute. Innocent III, the most important, influential, powerful man who ever held the seat of the papacy, knew that the church was falling down. And yet, what did he do in the Fourth Crusade? The Fourth Crusade briefly was digressed because of the Venetians, Catholics, openly, who essentially pulled a quick con act and says, here's the deal, we'll take you to Jerusalem if you attack the city for us. Well, the city happened to belong to the Greek to the Greek Empire. So when Innocent III learned about this, he says, you guys were raised to fight the Mohammedans. You were not raised to fight fellow Christians. I therefore excommunicate you. Now, a whole bunch of them went home, but a whole bunch of the other crusaders said, who cares? Hey, this is great. And they sacked Constantinople, set up the Christian empire, destroyed essentially the Greek empire, and weakened it so primarily that ultimately this was one of the reasons that the Islamic forces were able to take over Eastern Europe for so long. Now, the point was this. Here was the most powerful man who ever held the seat of Peter, talking to guys wearing red crosses, soldiers of God, and they wouldn't listen to him. What they wanted was money, of course, the relics. They wanted rape. They wanted land. They wanted this. Crusaders. Now, what I say is, I don't see evidence of that. St. Bernard. St. Bernard preached the Second Crusade. And as soon as he heard what was going on, he denounced it. And, of course, it failed. He said, you guys don't seem to understand this. This is a religious thing. And St. Bernard, by the way, interestingly enough, denounced the cathedrals. He thought they were a waste of money and a waste of time. And St. Bernard certainly was a good Catholic by any definition. And I'll make one other comment, which I thought was interesting. Again, St. Louis the Ninth, King of France, by any definition, an exceptional man, an exceptional saint. No criticism of him at all. But we have an awful lot of, we offer a lot of insights of him, because a guy who wrote, named Joinville, wrote a history of the Crusades and a biography of St. Louis. And here is Joinville, and an interesting thing that always stuck out to me, I mean, Joinville was a good Catholic too. There's no two ways about it. I think he talked about how his mother taught him certain ways to avoid blasphemy. They're very cute, but for anybody who's raised in a Catholic home, you can see this, really, okay? Here's Joinville at Mass, while they're in Egypt, before the eve of a battle. And there's seven knights out there making obscene, profane comments about somebody who had died and who's going to screw their wife when they get back to France during Mass. And he goes out and he says, can you guys at least keep your mouth shut up enough while we're having Mass? And as he said, and God saw to it that all seven of those guys were killed later. Now, seven knights who spent their vigil before they were knighted in the chapel, dedicating their swords in their honor to God. Knighthood, the whole thing that the church imposed on the Christian society. And here they were, mind you, in a battle, facing a battle the next day on a crusade. Why the heck weren't they in church listening to Mass like Joinville was? Because, quite frankly, they didn't care. And I think, again, we have this image that somehow things were absolutely wonderful then. Understand also the historical situation. The historian deals with the top level. By definition, the historian deals with the emperor, the king, the pope, the duke, the count, and occasionally the exceptional rebel. So what we have is the top lever, the so-called veneer of civilization. And if that, in fact, was more Christian, and maybe sometimes it was, again, we don't seem to have any leaders of the quality of Louis IX anymore, but as I also point out, his grandson kidnapped Boniface VIII and treated him so badly that he died in prison, essentially a form of judicial murder. Well, it didn't, and his mother was a saint, St. Blanche, I think. Well, it didn't seem to go very well in the bloodlines here. Well, I mean, you're running around, you know, this is the guy that had St. Thomas Aquinas over for dinner and stuff like this. I mean, this was a great, tremendous man. I mean, his behavior when he was captured, betrayed, into the hands of the Egyptian Mohammedans is absolutely exceptional. This man had, you know, literally was God incarnate in the perfect example of the Christian knight. Now, do you think he didn't care about his children? Do you think he didn't raise them correctly? Again, his mother was a saint, okay? What a great household. And you wind up with Philip the Fair grabbing Boniface VIII, throwing him into prison. That's when Boniface came out with his Unum Sanctum statements, because he wanted a French church, just like the American church. We think, and how often do they call France the eldest daughter of the church? Yeah, well, she's frequently a prostitute and a slut, it seems like, okay, going against it. The point I'm making is that a Christian society? If it was, God save us from Christian societies.
This ends side one. Before you turn over to side two, allow me a remark which I shall introduce at this point, which might clarify something given in the talk. The place in Connecticut where the Catholic Rendezvous was held is a small village where each Saturday a group of people who are protesting the possession by the United States of nuclear weapons stand in a silent vigil on the village green. They also carry and display a sign which says, "Join us." At the suggestion of one of the members participating at the Catholic Rendezvous, approximately 40 of us went and joined these people, but we carried anti-abortion signs, and we tried to make these people actualize their opposition to nuclear war more personal by also making them bear witness to their opposition to the killing of unborn children. The people, upon seeing our anti-abortion signs, immediately became offended. They removed their signs, and most of them moved away, although a few stayed for a short time to talk with us. I personally was able to engage two of these people in conversation and was able to point out to them the inconsistencies of their views of somehow opposing nuclear war, but at the same time not opposing the American Holocaust by which unborn children are slaughtered simply at the whim of their mothers. There was a reference made to this in both this tape and the other tape, which is came about as the result of this Catholic rendezvous, mainly the discussion with Carl Keating. And as I stated, I feel that if you understand the circumstances which occurred, mainly a confrontation between these people who are so in favor of peace and also so in favor of the slaughter of the unborn, that this dichotomy between their apparent moral values is something I refer to in the later part of the tape. With that in mind, I suggest that at this time you turn over to side two, where the talk will continue. Thank you.
Those things. And again, he did not come at that time for an accident. He did not come at the time when the Jewish nation, when the nation of Israel was independent and good. He came when it was downpressed, when it was ruled not only by Romans, but by a foreigner who was pretending to be a Jew. What he set up was a situation, I believe, to show us, don't worry about this stuff. This is not important. There's a vast cosmic battle going on in your soul every day. Deal with that. Don't worry about these other things. And as I sometimes say, I'll be quite willing to deal with that as soon as we all become perfect. Then I'll worry about the roads being paved. Then I'll worry about the Christian relationship here, the Christian relationship there. What we are dealing with, these things, is too personal of a matter. Let me deal with that slightly more, okay? This concept eats up time. Every moment you devote to so-called social causes which does not have a religious nature eats up time. Now let's be frank. Every human being has 24 hours a day. That's it. You sleep a certain amount, you eat a certain amount, there's certain other things you do of necessity which you cannot avoid. Now that leaves only a certain amount, an X amount of minutes a day in which you can do good. Let's also be reasonable. We don't do it. That doesn't mean to say we're doing bad, but we don't do conscious actions of good. Now there's certain times in our day when we're lazy, there's certain times when we're active. If we take those active times and we put it into pure religion, that is much better than to putting it into something that's quasi-religion. And that doesn't mean to say when you go in the voting booth, and you should vote, that you don't vote based on religious principles. But why are you advocating one candidate over another? If it's because he has a view on capital gains, and you do not have the Catholic view of capital gains, then you're literally taking time away from something else that should be better. Okay, now, if you have the Catholic view of capital gains, and you're personally theologically convinced that this guy is reflecting God's view on capital gains taxes, fine. I'm not criticizing that. But these things take away from the time we should be spending in good. We only have so much activism in us. And that doesn't mean to say we can't increase it. We should. I'm talking real. I'm talking the way we are now. I'm freezing a moment. At this point, each one of us has a certain capacity by which we will do actively good things. Now, if we do actively good things in a purely religious sense, we increase our chances of salvation, we make ourselves better, and convert, in the sense of the mystical body, we make the church better. If we divert that into, as these people do, as we referred to before, the anti-nuclear people, I mean, what are they against? They're against bombs being dropped on people. Gee, so am I. But why do we make fun of them? We make fun of them because their view is not religious. That's the real reason we make fun of them, and we should. They don't have the absolutely. We should, and I did. I did make. Well, I denounced them because it. I hold it that this is another point. What we're dealing with here is primarily spiritual conflicts. The conflict is between good and evil, between devil, and I usually say the Blessed Mother as opposed to God. Today I'll say the Blessed Mother, definitely, because Father said anything that doesn't mention the Blessed Mother is not good, so I'll throw that in being a safe side. I have a tendency to believe in one of my theological speculations that the devil acknowledges he can't be God, doesn't even try, so he goes against the Blessed Mother, and that's the real struggle on this earth. So when God comes back in the second coming, the fight's over. He, in his revulsion against the incarnation and his revulsion against human nature, fights against the most perfect, pure human being that is total human need live, and that is the fight. That's the struggle. But the point is, what is this struggle? It involves immense forces. I mean immense forces. Yes, God holds himself back or it would be over. The Blessed Mother doesn't. The saints don't. Our guardian angels don't. Angels.
Each one of us has an angel assigned to us, a fantastically powerful, potent being whose job is to get us to heaven. Immensely strong. Each one of us has that. Now, I'm not sure if each one of us has a demon. I'm not sure the collective nature of that. But the devil is an immensely strong thing, too. That is the struggle we engage in. That is the struggle we're involved in. Good, evil. Sin, repentance. Confession, reform. Virtue, vice. That's it. Now, when you realize the cosmic natures of those battles, the concept of what individual culture, and not culture, individual society you're living in, makes very little difference at all. It's an insignificant factor. And the problem is, it is a diverting factor. And that is my major problem that I see with it. If we emphasize the problem of the society, we forget to understand that our primary goal is to repent ourselves when we sin, to convert ourselves in more accord with God's will for us, which is outlined in the church whenever we get confused and I'm not sure what it is, and not to worry whether the roads are paved. Because people got to heaven before the roads were paved. People got to heaven before we had indoor plumbing. Jesus did not do things by accident or by mistake. He came in a time when it was primitive. It was the Iron Age, and not very that much into the Iron Age. And the things that Jesus had available to him in his normal human experience are what we would consider absolute, complete abuse. If you put a child into those circumstances today, the state or we would take that child away. We would say you cannot subject a child to not having electricity, not having indoor plumbing, not having penicillin, not having refrigeration, not having this, not having regular medical care, not having x-rays. But Jesus didn't have any of those things. And again, he did not come at that time for an accident. He did not come at the time when the Jewish nation, when the nation of Israel was independent and good. He came when it was downpressed, when it was ruled not only by Romans, but by a foreigner who was pretending to be a Jew. What he set up was a situation, I believe, to show us, don't worry about this stuff. This is not important. There's a vast cosmic battle going on in your soul every day. Deal with that. Don't worry about these other things. And as I sometimes say, I'll be quite willing to deal with that as soon as we all become perfect. Then I'll worry about the roads being paved. Then I'll worry about the Christian relationship here, the Christian relationship there. What we are dealing with, these things, is too personal of a matter. Let me deal with that slightly more, okay? This concept eats up time. Every moment you devote to so-called social causes, which does not have a religious nature, eats up time. Now, let's be frank. Every human being has 24 hours a day. That's it. You sleep a certain amount, you eat a certain amount, there's certain other things you do of necessity which you cannot avoid. Now that leaves only a certain amount, an X amount of minutes a day in which you can do good. Let's also be reasonable. We don't do it. That doesn't mean to say we're doing bad, but we don't do conscious actions of good. Now there's certain times in our day when we're lazy, there's certain times when we're active. If we take those active times and we put it into pure religion, that is much better than putting it into something that's quasi-religion. And that doesn't mean to say when you go into voting booth and you should vote that you don't vote based on religious principles. But why are you advocating one candidate over another? If it's because his view on capital gain and you do not have the Catholic view of capital gains, then you're literally taking time away from something else that should be better. Okay, now, if you have the Catholic view of capital gains and you're personally theologically convinced that this guy is reflecting God's view on capital gains taxes, fine. I'm not criticizing that. But these things take away from the time we should be spending in good. We only have so much activism in us. And that doesn't mean to say we can't increase it. We should. I'm talking real. I'm talking the way we are now. I'm freezing a moment. At this point, each one of us has a certain capacity by which we will do actively good things. Now, if we do actively good things in a purely religious sense, we increase our chances of salvation, we make ourselves better, and convert, in the sense of the mystical body, we make the church better. If we divert that into, as these people do, as we referred to before, the anti-nuclear people, I mean, what are they against? They're against bombs being dropped on people. Gee, so am I. But why do we make fun of them? We make fun of them because their view is not religious. That's the real reason we make fun of them, and we should. They don't have absolutely. We should. I denounced them because their view was not religious, and because when we went out there with our anti-abortion signs, they would not associate with us. They will not deal with the religious issue. How would we all have felt if some of them had said, "Well, you know, that's sort of related to us. We'll stay here too." Well, we quite frankly would have been disappointed because we went over there to smirk and make fun of them. And we weren't disappointed. They behaved exactly as we knew they would. Why? Because we knew their motivation wasn't religious. No matter what position they took, if their motivation wasn't religious, it will ultimately fall apart, even if on an individual issue we agree with them. Because obviously all of us at some point feel there's a certain amount of money that should be spent on nuclear weapons and no more. and then money either should be returned to us or done something else with. We all feel that way. The point I'm trying to make here is that when we can solve how we are perfect ourselves, when we get to that point, and if hypothetically we would, then is when we start figuring out what the role of censorship should be in our society and the role of courts. And I'm not saying these things are bad. And if you approach them from a Catholic point of view, that's fine. No criticism from me. But if you approach them from a social point of view, criticism from me. Do it for a Catholic reason or don't do it at all. Now again, personal confession. I still watch sports. I don't know any way to relate Catholicism to it. It's recreational. Yes, they should be doing something else, but I'm not doing something bad. And the point is here that I'm simply not doing something bad, and when I do something good, I do it for a pure reason. When I debate Protestants and when I used to constantly tell people what they should do, people frequently said to me, but you're claiming, you're giving this holier-than-thou attitude. And I said, I am holier-than-thou. Absolutely, there's no two ways about it. And I say it again now. Of course, absolutely. Here we go. I'm probably, and I can't say absolutely because I didn't get the special locution on this one, but I'm probably the holiest person in this room. You know why? Because most of you people have kind hearts. Most of you people are naturally nice. Anybody who knows me knows I'm not. Therefore, when the new mother over here tends to her child, of course she's doing God's will, but she also loves that child. Now, when I do anything nice for someone, it's because God said so. I want to get to heaven. I have no natural virtues whatsoever. I am a selfish person. I am a nasty person. I am a cruel person. I am a person who likes to be better than others. So what do? I suppress that for God's sake alone, and therefore, of course, I am holier than you and better than you, but I do it for a pure, supernatural motive. Why, you nice people, I sometimes feel very sorrowful for you. You nice people, because of God's sake, I don't like my neighbor. I know I try to make myself like it, and I can't, so look what I'm overcoming. I'm fighting a greater sin. You are nice people. You like one another. You're naturally pouring into it. You don't get as much grace as I do. Come my way, see? Almost guaranteed, okay? Now, the point is, okay, what I'm saying there is that, again, the concept of the social concept can waste time, can reduce you to a lower cause, and although objective good is still done when the people in Appalachia are fed by the government, and I'm not opposing that, by any means. Feeding the people is good. If it's not assigned to an individual, some grace is lost. And I think that's sometimes what the devil can do, is to divert you into the good act for the bad motive, so that you get this emotional satisfaction of seeing something good done, but you don't get the grace. And remember, it's grace and it's sin. Life is a pass-fail test. That's all it is. You ultimately get to heaven. You ultimately get to hell. That's it. That's the only success, the only failure that matters. And when you get involved in those things on earth, which we should be 24 hours a day, but we're not. But when you do get into that thing, when you're doing good, when you're avoiding evil, make it for the proper religious reason, so that you get the proper grace, so that you get the more increased chances of getting to heaven. The thing is here, think of the commandment that God gave us. Love God with everything. What does that mean if we follow it quite literally? Notice the second commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. If you take the first commandment quite literally, you can't love your neighbor, because you love God so totally, so completely, with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, you haven't got anything left for your neighbor. So I think this was thrown in as a sop for us, and for you natural people, so you can get to heaven too, you nice people. Love your neighbor as yourself, but love God first, okay? And notice the Pharisees. They were always dealing with the social problems. Notice their problems with John the Baptist. Well, gee, if we do this, the people will do that. Well, what about, we'll put Jesus to death. I mean, let's take Annas and Caiaphas at their word. We'll put Jesus to death so that a whole people doesn't suffer. Is it not better that one man die than a whole nation be destroyed? A social solution. Now, again, as I say, if you look at the crucifixion, one of the paradoxes of Catholicism, it was both the worst act and the best act that ever occurred. Okay? You know, it's that strange continuum of, if it's wrong to abort a child, it's much worse to abort a person who is better than a child. It's much worse to abort a very good person. It's much worse to appoint the best person to love it. It's much worse to destroy God. But if we didn't, we wouldn't get to heaven. So this horrible act is absolutely necessary for our salvation. But again, that doesn't justify Annas and Caiaphas, who said, better one man dies than a nation goes. And the Pharisees, well, gee, who's your authority, John? Well, gee, the people will get upset. Well, gee, look at the riot that's going on here. Well, gee, this, and gee, that. Social, 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 social. Well, you see, a man has, this man dies, and his brother marries his wife, and then his brother also marries his wife, and then he's got socials, and he says the same thing. Why are you asking me these stupid things? Why are you playing social games with me? I'm not Joyce Brothers. I'm not. That's exactly essentially what he said. Hey, the kingdom of God is within you. And God's talking to you every day.
Okay.
Now, what I essentially, in my emphasis, in my summation here, what I'd like to say is, in a certain sense, what I said before about Christendom, did it ever exist? Yes. In a certain sense, if we understand that something was imposed on all the relationships that said things are different. And I say, I advance as the founder of Christendom, St. Anthony of Egypt. Because St. Anthony of Egypt, as far as I know, and I could be wrong on this, but he's the main one, who said, hey, listen, I'm very different from all the other religions and very different from what the Jewish religion was. He said, you know what man can do? Man can flee his fellow man. Man can go in the desert, climb a tall pole, live up there for 50 years, you know, just stay in the cave. He can flee away. He can ignore his other people. He can ignore taxes. He can ignore social contacts. He can seek God himself and still be saved. So what I'm saying is Christendom, if we want to use that term, is saying that society now becomes irrelevant. And the Christendom society is one that has no society, or has every society. It doesn't matter. And therefore, this way, if we want to use it in a historical sense as a certain mindset that it exists at a certain time, yes. But if we're talking about it as a reality, no.
Okay.
And I think we should be grateful for that. Because if we wanted to define Christendom as what existed in, say, from, oh, say, 350 to 1450 in Western Europe, then I would say there's a very, very great danger here. Literally, a factor, a danger of sin. Why? Because at that point, we would be judging the church by its accomplishments on earth rather than the number of saved souls in heaven. And that is a very bad way to judge the church. I think when Jesus says things about don't judging, what he's saying is count heads when you get to heaven. Then up there, you might come up to people who say, oh, by the way, you influenced me to go to heaven. That's when you take credit for it, not down here. It means absolutely nothing if we somehow are instruments of conversion for everybody. They become devout Catholics and go to hell. What did they gain? The number of Catholics on this earth means nothing. In a certain sense, the church militant is not really that important. The church triumphant is the ultimate graduation class. And if I can throw in just essentially one postscript, the concept also of the church dealing with society, when you get the communication set up where the church says, yes, vote this way, do that, has a problem because the word becomes dialogue. Because once you open a level of communication, there's always the process of cross-influence coming back. And if the church starts teaching the society, the government, as an equal, if it starts saying these things, then what you have is the problem of the influence coming back. When you sit down at the table and discuss something, the other person opens his mouth. And I think it's wise the church has the priest stand up there and we sit in silence and listen. Now, maybe we get bored and maybe we don't pay attention, maybe we don't like it. But the principle is fine. The principle is shut up and listen. This is not a dialogue. This is a lecture. You take notes, you go home, and you do things. And that is one of the other dangers why the church should not be in society. And again, one last comment, just anticipating a question, and I don't know if we'll have time for it, is the following. This does not mean to say, as an example, that a Catholic politician does not have an obligation to vote the church's way. Of course he does. But the reason he has the obligation to vote that way is simply because it's Catholic behavior. The same way a Catholic congressman has an obligation to vote against abortion funding is not because of the social problems, but because he is a Catholic and he's obligated to do so. And I will therefore say, as I said on a radio show once, the Catholic Supreme Court justice has to totally ignore the Constitution in a matter that has morality and vote as if the salvation depended on it, because it probably does. And all of us have to behave that way. Now, that sometimes we'll now have, it may say the opposite, instead of a social good masquerading as a religious good, this will be a religious good that may appear to some people to be a social good. There's nothing wrong with that. But my position is, and I hope I've made the point, is that the church should not, does not, cannot, and shouldn't even attempt to have any direct relationship with society whatsoever. Only with the individuals, only to bring them to God, and our relationship would be individual to individual. Thank you.
Was given in November of 1990 at the Catholic Rendezvous held in Connecticut. And there was supposed to be a question and answer period at the end of the talk. Unfortunately, because of restrictions of times and an unfortunate scheduling problem, the question and answer period was cut short. However, one of the audience came up to me and pointed out a factual error in the speech. Because of that, I wish to remedy it right now. In the speech, I gave the clear implication that the cathedrals which were built during the ages of faith in Europe were, in fact, activities and as the result of single great men, in other words, significant rulers. In a certain sense, this is factually wrong. The classic example of the cathedral at Chartres, which was built by the common man and built with the cooperation of the entire community, certainly is a fact of history. And if history is to be believed, and I say it should be, in general, the cathedrals which now honor those cities and generally honor our Blessed Mother were, in fact, communal efforts built by the entire community. And because of this, they bear witness today to the effect of Catholicism on the people of the time. But I point out that a building itself does not reflect the internal relationship of a person to God. It is the internal relationship of a person to God, his state of grace or his state of sin, his vice or his virtue, which actually determines whether he is living the Christian life. His physical activity should, but not does not necessarily reflect his internal status. Therefore, what I meant to say, and I shall elaborate a little bit at this time, is should the entire community build the cathedral for the wrong reason, then the cathedral is built nonetheless. It, as a structure, as an architectural piece of art, still bears witness to man's activity, his talent, his nature, and in the sense that anything done well bears witness and gives glory to God, it gives glory to God. But it does not necessarily benefit those who built it. For example, if a man should participate and contribute to the building of a cathedral simply because he is the proprietor of an inn, and he understands that because a building is built in his community, his inn will increase its business, and therefore he will make more money, and his sole purpose, or his primary purpose, therefore, is greed, one of the seven deadly sins, then although he contributes nonetheless physically than another person whose motivation is purely religious, his own internal status, his own sense of vice and virtue, is not increased and not benefited. Again, here is an apparent social good, or even an apparent religious good, which underneath could very well be something sinful. I also point out that even though the cathedrals were built by a communal effort, the reason they were not built in every community is because of some circumstance which was unique to the places where the cathedrals were built. And I say then, and this is pure speculation, but I believe it is quite reasonable and quite defensible, that in situations like this, there is usually one or a few distinctive personalities who, combined with their motivation, their ability, and their skills, are able to motivate the community in general in such a communal project. I think all of us who have lived any period of time on this earth understand that committees will frequently start out with the best of intentions, and communal efforts will frequently start out with a burst of enthusiasm. But to keep the effort going over a significant period of time usually requires one or two supremely dedicated people whose vision and endurance is stronger and more focused than the average person. Without that type of person, most committees simply publish reports, plan, and never do. Therefore, what I'm saying is that although, again, the building of the cathedrals were communal in effort, I still believe, and again, this is speculation, but I think it is highly reasonable and highly probable speculation, that the reason the cathedral was built at Shortz and not at the village next to it was because at Shortz was that combination of personalities which were able to bring about a realization of the communal desire. Now, of course, it is also true that these cathedrals in general took generations to build. But I will also point out that some cathedrals never were built, although they were started. And once again, it took not only the communal effort, not only the strong individuals at one generation, but a continuation of individuals crystallizing and realizing the communal effort in a continuation of this structure, of this plan, to bring about the cathedrals that we see today. And once again, I point out that this is not evidence of the existence of Christendom any more than the lack of structures which have survived from, to use an example, the Hittite Empire, prove that the Hittite Empire did not exist. In other words, to say that something existed simply because its structures have survived, or to say that it never existed because its structures did not survive, is simply a process of drawing conclusions of from a physical reality to a spiritual reality. And this is something which I believe cannot be done. We cannot judge, as Jesus warns us, by appearances. We must judge justly by inner essences, by the heart of a culture, the heart of a group of people, if one can even use that word, must be judged again by their relationship to God. And although outward signs are necessary, outward signs are not sufficient to give us a proper judgment. I will make one further comment on my talk. At several times, I pointed out that I agree that there is such a thing as a Christian civilization, although not a Christian society. By civilization, I mean a common set of beliefs, values, and standards of evaluation dealing with behavior, art, and expressions of men in their relationships with one another. And this includes, of course, morality, worship, philosophy, and all forms of behavior. A civilization is a commonly accepted standard. Now, this does not mean to say that everyone in a civilization behaves that way. What it does mean to say is that the people in a civilization accept that they should behave in a certain way. They accept that they should admire and value certain artistic efforts, certain musical efforts, certain dramatical efforts, that they should value certain relationships such as marriage, children, behavior, schooling, education. Civilization is sort of the distilled essence of a group of people living in one place at one time who recognize themselves to be part of a community, or in a certain sense, part of a group of people who accept certain common values as more important than others. There have been, to my knowledge, Christian civilizations. It is my belief that the clearest example of a Christian civilization in the history of Christianity were those that took place in the areas of Paraguay and Uruguay in South America under the Jesuits. For here, as much as I can understand the historical records and as much as I have done the research, was truly the first century church, that is, the Church of the Acts of the Apostles, carried out in reality with the Native American Indians of that time. It was, in a certain sense, Christian socialism, as long as we understand socialism not as it is now presented, but as it was understood and practiced by Christian communities. And this culture, this set of standards, this civilization was recognized by its members as being distinct and its members fought literally to the death in many cases to maintain their distinct civilization. This civilization was a Christian civilization. This does not mean to say that there have not been examples of Christian civilization before or after. I am simply saying that this was, from what I can gather, the most successful example of it. A Christian civilization is not, again, necessarily recognized as successful by the behavior of its individuals, but by the values that it espouses and attempts to teach to it. A Christian civilization, therefore, would be possibly defined as a collection of individuals who recognize their commitment to accept as supreme the truths of God revealed through the Catholic Church. That would be a definition of a Christian civilization. And again, because we cannot determine the propriety of a person except by his outward behavior, we cannot determine the status of his soul, the amount of grace, except by a mystical evaluation of his state of his soul. And that we humans cannot do. Each one of us is called to do that to ourselves whenever we go to confession, to repent for our sins and examine our conscience. But none of us can truly judge what the status of another person is with God. And since the concept of Christendom, again, is sort of a collective evaluation of what a certain group of people existing in a certain place within a certain time period, and what their relationship is to God, to Christianity, to the Church, I say again, as I said before, that Christendom, except as an historical concept, as a term, as a way of expressing a certain period of history, has no meaning. It can have no meaning for us. Only when we, God willing, are in heaven, will we be able to determine whether there were more souls saved during the ages of faith, or there were more souls saved during the ages of reason, or more souls saved today, which is neither reasonable nor faithful, an age of unbelief and an age of irrationality. And, as I've stated before, the only true value of any period of history's success is the number of souls which ultimately enter heaven and avoid damnation. I hope that these clarifying remarks have illuminated somewhat my talk and cleared up any misunderstandings which might have arisen. I also will point out to any listener that the debate with Carl Keating, who is the author of Catholicism and Fundamentalism and head of the organization Catholic Answers and publisher of the magazine This Rock, Carl being a Catholic apologist located in California, took place later in this rendezvous. And that tape is available from All Roads Ministry. The debate dealt primarily